Next case is 98-26-94, State of Ohio, Maxwell Gary Gray. This is Harry Russell Warden and Richard Haddad and Andrew White. This is Russell Warden.
Hello. This should be sent back to another room. I noticed them all.
I agree, but then they'll just find it. Except the player again.
But you know what? We can move on though. If we judge one, we have to give notice to the defendant. Now the sexual predator appears.
Under Senate Bill 2, a judicially imposed sentence consists of several elements. One element is what the statute calls a stated prison term, say 4 years in case of aggravated robbery. Another element is what the statute calls bad time, that is the authority of the parole board to extend the initial stated prison term by increments 30, 60, 90 days, up to one half of the initial stated prison term. The statute makes explicitly clear that the bad time authority is part of the judicially imposed sentence. Indeed, the statute says that the sentencing judge must inform the criminal defendant at sentencing of this bad time authority and must inform the defendant that the sentence includes any bad time so imposed pursuant to that authority. Moreover, the combined effect of these two judicially imposed elements of the same sentence means that there is no absolute right of relief upon completion of the initial stated prison term. And this is a constitutionally dispositive point. The right of relief at the end of the initial stated prison term is conditional. It's contingent on good behavior for the duration of that initial stated prison term.
Counsel, does any other state have that term?
Other states have different forms. My understanding is that Ohio is unique in its particular form of that term.
Do any of them pose it as an extension of a sentence, a platform sentence, in any state?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the details of the other systems.
Nobody quoted any cases from anywhere else.
And we're not aware of any published opinions. But the point here, again, is that this case falls within the principles announced in Wolf and Morrissey because this is a conditional liberty case, not an absolute liberty case.
Every one of those cases involved a shortening of a sentence that had already been given.
True, but if I might respond in two ways. One is this system, the backup system, actually has more judicial control over the length of a sentence. There's less administrative discretion under bad time than under the previous system. As you suggested, under the old system, the sentence could be from 4 to 25 years, with good time could be reduced to 3 to 25 years. That would leave the defendant essentially with the unfettered discretion of the parole board to decide in each and every time in a parole hearing, is this defendant ready for release or do they need to stay in the system?
So the sentence the judge hypothetically gives the defendant is an extension to 4 years plus an indeterminate amount of time for future crimes you may commit in prison.
Well, the way that time works is there's a 4 year minimum, it can't be less. And indeed, at sentencing, you're told it may get extended up to 50%. So it's on 4 year minimum, up to 6. And that's constitutionally indistinguishable for constitutional principles from the time of 4 to 6 years that preceded it. And to your earlier question, it makes no difference for purposes of constitutional law whether the sentencing judge does one of the following: I sentence you to 4 to 6 years, and the parole board can decide whether it's 4 years, 6 years, or somewhere between, at the parole board's discretion. Or alternatively, under that time, I sentence you to a minimum of 4. You won't be released to a parole board. But the parole board can extend that sentence. Now, I'm telling you that right now as part of your judicial sentence, that they have that authority. And they're exercising, because it's conditional, they're exercising the same authority as they did before. Namely, if there's been bad behavior while in prison, under this system, the parole board gets to make the judgment whether that behavior warrants retention within the system or whether you're ready to be released. But it does so under much more circumscribed situation. For one thing, here, the defendant gets to determine, in essence, they get to leave at the end of 4 years if, again, conditionally, if they've been good. But the parole board can't keep them in simply because they've, acted surly to prison guards or, have improved behavior. It has to be a serious offense, like the assault in these three cases. And the parole board can exercise this judgment here only upon a factual finding by clear and convincing evidence that a misdeed has occurred. So the standard and discretion is much narrower under this context than under the previous decision. That's why, in our judgment, there was no minority report to the Sentencing Commission, and there was no serious objection to that time as it moves through the legislature.
Usually when somebody allegedly commits a crime, we arrest that person, indict them, try them, give them a jury trial if they ask for it. Now, I recognize how efficient this procedure is by just cutting out all of those constitutional protections, but isn't that what we're doing? I mean, you got an administrative agency after an initial person who might very well be angry at some prisoner for some reason, making the finding that he's committed a crime, we're going to add to his time, with none of the constitutional protections afforded at all. Is that something we should condone?
In this respect, Your Honor, this case is no different from parole revocation or good time revocation. In a parole revocation context, someone could be brought back into prison for a parole violation without a criminal trial. And in the good time revocation case, Wolf, the U.S. court said it was imperative that prison officials have the authority to make these kinds of swift and sure decisions.
But is parole revoked without going before a neutral magistrate? The prison authorities have the right themselves to just revoke parole and send the person back?
It's the same parole board, Your Honor. The act cannot be imposed.
I'm not talking about, you said that the same procedure takes place with a parole violation. The person is released beyond parole. My question is that done administratively or is that done in a court of law?
That's done administratively.
So it's the same as this?
Exactly. And it is the same parole board. Under the bad time scheme, there is a role for the warden, to be sure, but the warden's decision must be reviewed by the parole board itself to ensure continuity statewide.
You must be doing it differently than when I did it. Whenever you had somebody on parole, they violated parole, the parole officer himself or herself could actually pick them up and incarcerate them. But then there had to be a hearing. I mean, you just didn't say, okay, I've decided you violated parole. Don't you think so too, parole board? Go back to jail forever. There was always a hearing.
Absolutely correct, but not a judicial hearing, or at least not constitutionally required to be judicial. And in that respect, this is the same. Under the Wolf and Morrissey cases...
Yeah, but the person's all... I know I've been there, I've represented them. You're there at the hearing on the parole revocation.
Correct.
I mean, there's at least a mini-trial, a quasi-trial.
But not a judicial trial with all the right of a criminal file. Okay. Morrissey is explicit on this point, as is Wolf. And there is a hearing in this context. There is a hearing in the administrative context here, and then it is reviewable by the parole board. And the key point or constitutionally, is there's no constitutional distinction between a 4 to 6 year sentence that's indefinite under the old system, where the parole board has the discretion, again, to be, is it going to be 4, is it going to be 6, or is it somewhere in between, or under this system, where it's 4, you know it's 4 and no less, but it could be taken out of 6. Again, the discretion that the parole board has under the Vatican law is less, and it's consistent with separation of powers and consistent with due process, because the judge imposes the initial judicial criminal sentence, and then that less discretion, but appropriate discretion, in the parole board to make determination. This system also achieves two goals that I think are imperative to mention. One is the goal of sending the right message. What Senate Bill 2 wants to do is say that good time is expected, not rewarded. That is why it's an important reform, even though the constitutional principle is the same. The effective is that the sentencing judge, at the time of judicial sentencing, tells the defendant, you've just committed a crime, a serious crime, that warrants imprisonment. And now it's your job to prove that you're able to obey the law. And if you can do that for your initial term, then you can be released. But if you cannot obey the law even while you're incarcerated, then you have no automatic right to release. Then the authority of the parole board kicks in conditionally and can make the judgment, the kind of judgment that they always made, that you're not rehabilitating yet.
Are all sentences
at present
time in Ohio definite sentences?
I'm not sure that I can answer that question fully. Under Senate Bill 2, we have the new regime of this initial stated term, which is definite in that sense, but sentences have two parts, and the additional component is conditional and can't be added up.
That's what experience is, the fact that a defendant is told you're sentenced to 4 years, and then the judge goes on and says, yeah, because your behavior in prison needs to be extended. And the administrative agency is extending the original definite sentence. That's trouble. There's no neutral magistrate involved to hear this.
The Wolf case and the Morris case specifically say that for constitutional purposes, the parole board is a neutral magistrate. And it's the sentencing judge that says the parole board has this authority. No different than before in that. Again, 4 to 6, when the parole board having authority is how we did it before, and it's how we do it now, but with more constraints on the parole board, it's more judicial control over sentencing, more the clear and convincing evidence standard, and the ability to oppose this
Thanks.
Only for specific misdeeds, makes this an appropriate response. It's in keeping with the truth in sentencing and the honesty in sentencing that the Senate Bill 2 wanted to do. Now, there is total notice to the defendant at time of sentencing. 4 means 4, not less, but it also means the possibility of getting something additional. The other key purpose behind that time is, again, prison officials, the system, the warden and the parole board, the prison authority, need the ability to respond to serious breaches of prison disorder, like the assault in this case. If prisoners assault the guard, there needs to be a mechanism of response. And
they have that ability. I mean, the current system before the Senate time came into effect is if you have a violation, you've got solitary confinement, you've got lots of privileges, you've got a whole bunch of sanctions, if it's serious enough to rise into the level of crime, the prosecutors, like the prosecutor all the way to the prison line, bring them back to court, get those sentences passed on, and they get all the due process protection. It seems to me in this case, you've got a serious crime, you've cut out any executive on behalf of the prison to take it to a trial so they can move it administratively.
With all respect, Your Honor, for due process and separation of powers purposes, it is permissible to give prison authorities this additional tool besides solitary confinement law for the privileges. The Wolf case said there should be no constitutional straitjacket of forcing you to have a new criminal trial. And the reason for that is it's important for prisoners to know that they have to respect prison authority. And it's their authority, the authority of the prison system, to be able to respond, as Will said, a swift and sure response. This statute provides a swift and sure response to an actual experience.
But in the Lucasville riots, they were all prosecuted separately.
Well, there may be, we don't disagree with that, there may be occasions where conduct within prison
might do both.
Should be referred, but there's no constitutional requirement that it be referred. Right. Again, under the old system, the prison administrators could revoke good conduct, which would have the effect of extending the sentence. So it was already in place. There could be these administrative extensions, if you will, for prison misconduct. They didn't have to be referred to criminal prosecution. And again, Wolf is specific on this point in page 563 of the opinion. The court details exactly why it's appropriate for prison officials to have this authority. I see my time's up. I'd like to reserve the floor.
That's 30 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foley. Good stuff.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Mr. Foley. My name is Jill Stone, and I'm here on behalf of Appellant Gary Gray, excuse me, Appellee Dan White, and Petitioner Richard Haddad. I would like to begin by saying that prison officials have no authority to alter an inmate's sentence, original criminal sentence imposed by a court of law. That is what bad time does. It takes the original definite sentence imposed by the court, by statute 29-29-14, and changes it. This is not the
In effect, under this statute, we really don't have a definite sentence. Because the judge is saying, I'm sentencing you to 4 years, but you can receive 30, 60, etc. additional days. So that time is extended.
Justice Rudd, that the effect of bad time is to extend the time, you're correct. But the statute that sentences the offender that we have definite terms of imprisonment, which was recently defined by this court in Youngkin versus Wilkinson, which is that a definite term means what it says. Under our constitutional foundation, it is the court who imposes the sentence, and under the statute, that sentence is a definite term. Now, the parole board extension of the sentence is not pursuant to any authority of the court. It is pursuant to the legislative authority granted to it by the General Assembly. And that authority violates separation of powers. The sentencing, the prosecution, the judicial trial of an offender for the commission of a criminal offense rightfully lies with the court of law and not with an administrative body like the parole board. And that person is entitled to all the concomitant procedures of due process and equal protection that our law allows. Bad times does not provide for that at all. Now, the separation of powers is violated in two ways. First of all, the parole board significantly alters and amends the trial court sentence. For example, if the trial court sentences someone to a year in prison, that is the definite term that he imposes. The parole board, under the guise of that sentence, alters, amends, and extends that judgment of the court by 30, 60, or 90-day increments, whatever it chooses, if the inmate commits new criminal conduct while in prison. And note that for a violation of criminal offenses that result in bad time, there is no distinction between the conduct that is involved in bad times and the conduct that is involved in the prosecution of the case. It is the same. So in effect, the whole prosecution of the case is transformed from being in a court of law and now in an administrative body.
So every one of the infractions that leads to bad times could result in a
suspension of prosecution. By definition, the conduct is a criminal offense under the state or federal law. That definition is found in 29-29-01-B, and it can only be for a criminal offense.
This bad behavior generally is not
Correct. Bad behavior does not warrant that time. It's only a new criminal offense. Now, the Attorney General's reliance on Morrissey and Wolfe is misplaced, because Morrissey and Wolfe dealt with the issue of state-related liberty interests and what due process was due in those circumstances. Under Morrissey and under Wolfe, the state had created a parole revocation process or parole process of revocation. And under Wolfe, the issue had to do with good time credit, similar to what we had under the law or law and their revocation. First of all, it's important to note that there is no right to parole and there is no right to good time credit. But once the state created those interests, then the question under the 14th Amendment was what due process is due. This is constitutionally significant and very different when you compare it to the imposition of bad time. An inmate has an unqualified liberty interest in the release at the end of his prison term. It's not qualified by anything. The court imposes the sentence for conduct that results in that sentence. And when his term is up, all the liberty interests inherent in our Constitution and the federal Constitution attached to him. That is an unqualified liberty interest that the phrase is liberty interest that jumps out of us from the 5th and 14th Amendment. So those cases that talk about the reduced due process value procedures that attend parole revocation and the loss of trip time is because it doesn't encompass, those rights do not encompass all the core values of the 14th Amendment. Distinguish that from the situation where a person is sentenced to a term by a court, a definite term, and his term, lo and behold, does not end at the end of his sentence. It is a parole board who extends it for new conduct that the court, in effect, had no jurisdiction over at the time he was sentenced. So those cases are not appropriate to rely upon when determining whether or not minimal due process rights are preserved. It is interesting to note also that the parole revocation process that Justice Douglas was referring to does provide far more minimal due process protection than the process that is available here in terms of the RIV procedure that happens. But nonetheless, it is still based on diminished liberty protection that doesn't require the full-blown protection that a criminal trial does.
How does the prison authorities keep control of the prison population?
Justice Sweeney, the manner of keeping control is the traditional methods that have always been used. First of all, I would like to point out that there is nothing sure or swift about the imposition of bad time. Bad time itself isn't served until the end of a prison term, so the penalty itself isn't felt at the time of the conduct. What is felt at the time of the conduct is what happens to most of these people when they're charged with misconduct. They are put in administrative control, they might be segregated, loss of privileges, changes of institutions, loss in job status. Those are the traditional methods of disciplining somebody in a prison environment, which has been consistent with prison security.
Would bad time eliminate those features?
Bad time doesn't affect those features at all. In fact, every one of these gentlemen I represent is subject to those immediate disciplinary actions at the time of the event. So
that's an additional penalty on top of the ordinary methods that the institution has.
Correct. It is an additional penalty and also an atypical penalty, and one that significantly changes and amends the penalty or the time for which he served. It is an alteration and extension of his sentence. In U.S. v. Maine,
so are they subject to both the ordinary administrative procedures and bad time?
Correct. Absolutely. In fact, when the inmate typically has 24 hours to prepare their defense to whatever the charges are, but during that 24 hours, they're typically in administrative control or segregation, which would obviously make it very difficult to prepare a defense to something like assault. So these procedures move very quickly. The local control mechanism, all those traditional methods of prison discipline that are imposed quickly and virtually immediately on inmates still are in effect. None of that changes. And in fact, for example, there's nothing to say that bad time cannot be imposed 20 years after the fact. So there's no swiftness there. That is not there is no rational relationship between the swiftness and the punishment and when the punishment is imposed. But as I indicated earlier, under the separation of powers doctrine, first of all, the parole board then the prisoner sentence, and secondly, there is no judiciary that is interposed between the executive or the charging body and the citizen. So here, as the court noted in White v. Conte, and as other courts have noted who have dealt with related issues, it is the judiciary itself that is missing, and all those concomitant protections that the judiciary is designed to see is afforded to people who are accused of crime. Now, as to the due process protections, Mr. Bray, Mr. White, and Mr. Hadda all insist that the due process protections that are afforded an offender in a criminal trial should apply in this case. Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez is the case that resolves the question as to whether or not bad time is punishment or prison discipline. Prison discipline traditionally being what Justice Sweeney referred to, local control and punishment, which is a sentence in the penitentiary or jail for criminal conduct. Now, and when analyzing and looking at the Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez factors, it is clear that every factor involved in that analysis applies to bad time. It is clearly punishment. The General Assembly says in 2011, the purpose of bad time is to punish. There is no doubt about it. It is a criminal penalty. Imposition of prison time is a criminal punishment. It is the traditional method of punishment. Use of prison to force or compel testimony is not considered punishment. The cases that the Attorney General referred to, those old cases like in Ex parte Doven. But punishment for an offense that results in prison is a traditional method of punishment. There's an affirmative disability or restraint. Incarceration is regarded as punishment. You can only be punished on a finding of scienter, which goes hand in hand with the commission of a criminal offense. It fulfills the traditional aims of punishment, retribution, and deterrence. Defensive behavior is a crime. All these defenses are crimes. And there is no alternative purpose assigned to it, at least by legislation, because the purpose is set out as punishment, and it is clearly excessive. It is excessive because it alters and amends the inmate's sentence. Now, again, I refer this court to United States versus Maine, which is an 11th Circuit court that was cited in our brief. In that case, the question was whether or not double jeopardy applied to the imposition of prison sanctions such as local control, segregation, and transfer. And in that case, the court applied the factors and said, no, there is no jeopardy problem with independently charging somebody with a criminal offense. In that case, there was a riot. But the court made it clear that prison officials cannot alter and amend an inmate's sentence. And that is what happens here. That is what is endorsed by the General Assembly. That is what is accomplished by the parole board. And that altering and amending of the sentence is a violation of due process and separation of powers.
Counsel, what would be the right to go back to the old indeterminate exactly how long it would be.
decision as to how to address the prison misconduct, if that's the question, is a legislative judgment. Congress being...
So they should have just stuck with the system, okay?
Well, certainly, number one, the other system was constitutional. Number two, the question of truth in sentencing is... There is no truth in sentencing with bad time because the sentence that is imposed is again not the sentence received.
The argument is that there is a good time either because victims set the program and go about this very tough sentence.
What stems the General Assembly, or how the General Assembly is going to deal with this problem, fails to take into account that for this kind of behavior, people can be prosecuted. And it is that method that is our traditional method of dealing with people who break the law. I'm not sure why someone who's in prison should be treated any differently. If you commit a serious offense, why only 30, 60, or 90 days should be imposed on the one hand? Is that cheapening the criminal conduct just because it occurs in a prison versus if that offense occurred somewhere else? So that is our method of punishing criminal wrongdoing, which is to take it to court.
Of course, the statutory scheme here would allow that to, if there were a murder, for instance, prison officials thought, you know what, 90 days isn't going to be nearly enough to address that, so we will go to court. That the prison officials can opt for a court filing charges and having it heard in court. That they can do that, does that then make this scheme unconstitutional? That the legislature cannot prescribe this scheme when you have the option, but you also have the option not to?
If the state has the option of proceeding against an offender while in prison, pursuant to that time for a serious offense like a murder, and proceeding and imposing punishment for it, then they really, under my interpretation, under the Double Jeopardy Clause, they would be precluded from criminally prosecuting.
No, I don't suggest that this is an overlapping. Maybe that's a question for another day, but in terms of, as an alternative, go to court, or because you find it more serious, for instance, but it doesn't matter. Does that harm the constitutionality of it?
The decision on whether or not to prosecute doesn't change because of that time. That is normally a prosecutorial decision. The case is taken to the grand jury and the case proceeds. The decision on whether or not to go forward on a bad time charge or not, again, is an institutional issue. The complaining officer makes a complaint. It's quickly reviewed, and then you have your IRB hearing.
But say the prison officials didn't choose that route. They chose instead to say, you know what, we're not going to extend your prison time in accordance with your sentence, arguably, but we're going to instead prosecute you and see if you're not convicted and get another sentence. It would also include bad time, by the way, right? I mean, it would.
Or the court finds that it's non-constitutional. The decision not to pursue a bad time charge has nothing, is not based on whether or not there is a violation. To determine whether or not violate.
Your time's up, and I think we're not talking the same question, so that's okay.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Fully, you have time to take 30 seconds. 15.
With all respect to the public defender's office, I believe I've heard some important statements that I need to correct. I thought I heard on several occasions the Stone saying that bad time by the parole board alters or amends the sentence. That is not correct. It's an extension of the stated prison term. The statute is clear that it defines stated prison term differently from the sentence. There is no altering of the sentence itself. The sentence itself is
clear. Would you explain that further?
It's an additional term.
We were talking about 4 years. The defendant is told it's being sentenced to 4 years. The bad time doesn't start until 4 years has been served. Is that correct?
Correct, but if I might, the sentence is not 4 years. The stated prison term is 4 years, which is just one component of the sentence. So it's a little bit loose in language with all respect to say the sentence is 4 years. Stated prison term is 4 years, and then there's the possibility of bad time, which is also part of the sentence. So when the parole board acted, it's never altering the sentence itself. It's all only extending the stated prison term, which is a component of the sentence. So that when there are assertions, for example, like there's an unqualified right to release at the end of the 4 years, that is incorrect under the statutory regime. It is qualified because, again, stated prison term is only a component.
When you're setting that,
what number is your transgender state? I sense you do that for 4 years, maybe.
Well, maybe.
Thank you.
Right.
That's what you feel. So that's what you're looking for.
Well, what the defendant must know, because notice is required, is that there is a 4-year minimum term, which is part of the sentence, but it's not the only part. It's the only part if there's good behavior, and that's the conditional element. And the defendant, if on good behavior, will walk it for, but it won't walk it for if there's bad behavior, serious misconduct, can't amount to a crime. The fact that it's a crime is constrained again on the discretion. So what the defendant should well realize is that they're in necessarily for 4, but they may be in for longer, up to 6, the 50% extension, because that is explained as part of the sentence at the outset. And just to remind the court, this is a facial challenge to back on the before this court. And so the question here is whether bad time in any form whatsoever is permissible. And we believe we maintain, as we said in the reason here today, that the concept of bad time is defined in the statute, and in the statute is consistent with all constitutional principles.
Thank you, Mr. Foley.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. We'll be advised of our opinion.